Faculty Conference. And my name is Eugene Meyer. I'm president of the society. I want to turn this over to our moderator for our first panel, Doug Kamik, and we're a professor from Pepperdine. And I want to ask Doug, in addition to moderating the panel, he's also going to be playing a dual role in pinch hitting for Sai Prakash, who fell ill and couldn't make it. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Doug. Actually, I'm sorry. There's one other thing I wanted to do before I did that. We have a new faculty division director, Haley Reynolds. I want to ask Haley to stand, and for those of you who have not met her, I want you to introduce yourself to her. She is back there. Raise your hand, Haley. Hi. Thanks. Okay, Doug.
Good evening, and a happy new year to all of you. The formal topic of our symposium or our seminar or our conversation this evening is, may a president disregard a congressional statute for national security reasons? And we have a distinguished panel to address this question. As Gene mentioned, unfortunately, Sai became ill with pink eye. Anyone who's ever had children know what pink eye is. And know that we're grateful that Sai is not here. Now, what statutes are we talking about? One might well begin with the venerable War Powers Resolution. After all, this was a statute that was not only passed over a presidential veto, but it has also been a statute that in its entire history has been ignored and functionally complied with to the letter by every president since. Ignored in the sense that every succeeding president has termed it unconstitutional and an encroachment upon executive power. Complied with in the sense that every president that I know of in introducing troops into military hostility says, here's a little note we think you'd like to know that consistent with the War Powers Resolution, but not in compliance with it, we have introduced troops into the following locale. Now, of course, more immediately, there are other statutes at issue, and a statute that has received enormous attention and I suspect will be given considerable treatment by our distinguished panelists is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, by which the president has authorized the terrorist surveillance program. There are other topics that may also interweave with the discussion this evening, the president's ability to engage in extraordinary rendition, to the extent that the president is engaging in extraordinary rendition, contrary to either treaty obligation or U.S. statute, the president's ability to use aggressive forms of interrogation, that's a euphemism, contrary to treaty and incorporated statute, and something that one of our guests this evening has written about extensively recently in a new book, the assertion of the state secrets privilege in the context of litigation brought by private parties. Now, in our preliminary talks, we agreed in particular to ask questions along the following lines. Where the president might be possessing of a particularly good justification to disregard a particular statute, and if he has that particularly good justification to disregard a statute, how might he mitigate the impact of that confrontation in terms of is there a practical mechanism that he might use in his conversations with the Congress or with the leadership of Congress to some degree mitigate the impact of seemingly disregarding statutory law. Where the president might be justified in disregarding a judicial construction of a statute seems to be a necessary corollary question. Not that the Supreme Court has a tendency to involve itself in foreign affairs. We know how deferential they can be. But if, in fact, at some point they become less deferential or that they continue their position in Hamden, to what degree can the president respond if he no longer has Congress on his side, which, according to the USA Today, he doesn't? Now, These are essential questions, and here's a brief introduction to help you know the players and, to some degree, their positions. The pro-Congress side of this debate is sometimes stated as the side of the debate that requires pre-approval for any military action or foreign affairs intervention that the president will undertake. The pro-presidential side of this debate is basically no approval is necessary because powers have been granted formally or implicitly in the constitutional structure. Now, there are gradations in between, and some of those gradations involve the extent to which Congress can assert its power of funding to deny presidential power, and it's an interesting question to know whether Congress both contemplates that it has that authority and how practically they could, in fact, do that, and also the extent to which the president makes efforts to keep Congress informed. It seems to me that there are two basic questions, foundational precepts, if you will, that guide this discussion or need to be answered. One is a question that asks as follows, is the Constitution a higher law that contains inherent powers and necessarily trumps statutes? And a second question, is the purpose of the Constitution to create a pliable, functional, workable, living, dynamic arrangement of governing authority with respect to foreign affairs? I would suggest that on the first question, Federalists would generally tend to answer the question that of course the Constitution is law, and of course the Constitution necessarily has supremacy over a transient statute. With regard to the second question, whenever the word living is used, we have a tendency to not be for that. And with good reason, because we know something is being smuggled into the debate. But in this particular area, the founding principles that are given to us about the federative or foreign policy power, as Locke describes it, that are given to us by Blackstone in the commentaries, is that the executive, as the executive engages in foreign affairs authority, must have a considerable degree of discretion. Discretion, to be sure, to be exercised for the common good, but discretion nonetheless, and discretion that cannot be seriously cabined by artificial boundaries constructed in statutes. If that is the case, and if those are the founding principles, then notice that to some degree the normal proposition that the Federalist supports has a kind of two-headedness to it. We simultaneously want the Constitution seemingly to be its formal self, and at the same time we want a lot of let's work this out as we go along, which is more akin to those who make other arguments in the domestic field than we are usually comfortable with. Be that as it may, there is good evidence in the founding materials that would have been available to the framers, for example, in Blackstone, that this discretion for the common good in the area of foreign affairs, this discretion, if you will, to violate a statute, is a discretion that is checked primarily by two mechanisms, funding, that is, the ability of the Parliament, or in our case, the Congress, to deny the ability of the executive to undertake the adventure because no resources will be supplied, or impeachment, and very little else in between. Now, it's fair to say that modernly we think there's a great deal else in between, and that the Congress does not view its authority over appropriations to be very meaningful to itself, either because they lack the political will to assert it, or because there is enough generally appropriated money that the ability to stop the president from a military adventure in advance just seems to me to be, or to them, to be far-fetched. And secondarily, certainly the president is no advocate as impeachment as the only remedy for extending beyond the scope of authority as others may see it. He would argue, I think, quite properly for a civil discourse that would suggest, can't we all get along and reason this out together? Our first speaker this evening to answer some of these questions and to explore others is Dr. Louis Fisher, who for 36 years had worked for the Congressional Research Service, but most recently has joined the Law Library of the Library of Congress. Dr. Fisher is an extraordinary scholar in his own right, the author of many books, including a highly popular constitutional text that is used not just in law schools, but widely in government and political science schools as well, and most recently a book, In the Name of National Security, Unchecked Presidential Power, in the Reynolds case. That tends to suggest where Dr. Fisher will bring us in his presentation, and I'll let him begin now. Dr. Fisher.
I guess to identify us, you have to have labels, and I'm under the pro-Congress, I don't know, John Yoo, pro-executive. I hope we don't have to do that. I don't know why anyone would want to be attached to one branch and a three-branch government, and I hope people in the federal society don't find that appealing. I think somewhere, if we were in a different place, there'd be a silhouette of James Madison. I think he had something to do with separation of powers and checks and balances. So, and in fact, I've testified many times before Congress, and I've often testified against Congress and often testify that the bill they have would trench upon presidential power or weaken judicial power. And people wonder why, since I'm a staff person for Congress, I should care about the other two branches. And, of course, that's what the Constitution is. So I always say that I'm pro-Constitution. I think John Yoo is pro-Constitution. I don't think it makes any sense to line up 100% behind one branch. As far as the question we're faced with tonight, can a president ignore a statute on national security grounds? My short answer would be in some situations, but I'd have to explain why. And I think a good situation, the greatest crisis we've ever had, is what Lincoln faced at the start of the Civil War, where he took certain actions, not necessarily against a statute, but in the absence of a statute. That's the Lockean prerogative. And he never claimed, however, which this administration does, to have some kind of exclusive power. He said, in this type of emergency, facing the necessity I am, I did take certain actions that are outside my powers. And I say outside my powers because you remember he said that he was convinced that what he did in those early weeks was not outside the combined power of Article 1 and Article 2. So he was conceding right away that he stepped out of Article 2, he picked up whatever of Article 1 he wanted to, and to that extent, he said he didn't go outside the Constitution. He went outside Article 2, but not outside the Constitution. Very, very important way for the president to say, I'm working as best I can within the constitutional system. Then, very important also, since he stepped outside Article 2, he, under the prerogative, was required to come to Congress and get authority to make legal what was illegal. And that is what he did. And the burden was on him to make the case of why he had to act and what he did and why he needed authority. And if you read the debate on his request, you'll see that members understood that he did not have legal authority to do what he did, and he needed, therefore, a statute retroactively authorizing what he did, which is the way it happened. So I think in an extraordinary situation like that, after April of 1861, you can make a case where a president may have to act illegally for the public good. It's not for some partisan advantage or something else because some family member was threatened at some point. No, it has to be for the public good. So that's a prerogative. To get a little bit more specific, there's an interesting situation in 1971 with the Mansfield Amendment. It was an early effort by Congress to put some restrictions on the Vietnam War and to get the president to disengage and pull back. And if you look at the Mansfield Amendment, it appeared in two different places in 1971. It's a pretty vague statute. Gives the president certainly a good deal of discretion as to what to do, just general guidelines. And the bill came to Nixon. He signed into law, and, of course, he had a signing statement. And he said that the Mansfield Amendment does not represent the policy of this administration. And that wasn't the end of the story, because it was litigated, and it was brought before a district judge the next year, in 1972. And he very, very clearly said that when the president signed that act with the Mansfield Amendment, that was law, not anything else the president would want to do as an alternative, that the act signed into law was binding, and the president was obliged to see that the law was faithfully carried out. Now, of course, as I said, there's some discretion to it, but it wasn't a case where a president could just thumb his nose at a statute, sign it, and say, sorry, that doesn't represent the policy of this administration. So that's something for you to look at. There's also a very interesting situation with Iran-Contra in the Reagan administration, where there were, as you remember, four or so different Boland amendments prohibiting assistance to the Contras. And people deride it because they say, oh, four different amendments, you can hardly tell what's going on. Well, the reason there were four different amendments is that the first, second, and third, the administration found ways of running around it, running through it. And finally, the fourth Boland Amendment was about as clear as you could possibly make statutory language, no assistance direct or indirect to any agency or entity of the executive branch, on and on and on. I think there was an opportunity, if President Reagan wanted to, in a signing statement to say, I'm not going to implement this, it invades my powers. He did not do that. There's nothing in the Office of Legal Counsel or the Attorney General's office to suggest that there was anything unconstitutional about the Boland Amendment. After that became law, there were hearings, and the administration sent up a witness who said, he was asked, are you going to play games? Has some lawyer find some kind of language that you can exploit? And he says, we know what it means. We're not going to do that. We're going to comply with the Boland Amendment. And at the same time that person was testifying, there were efforts, I think, outside his knowledge, of the administration going to private families for money, pay a certain amount, you can get a helicopter, whatever, going to different countries, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, for money, handout, that's called tin cup diplomacy. And then finally that publication in Lebanon about what the hell was going on. And I don't know, John, you might have a different take on this, but I think the administration knew that any position by President Reagan to the effect that you passed the Boland Amendment, but I'm not going to comply with it because I've got my own independent Article II powers, would have been an impeachable act. And Ed Meese and others, I think, understood that. And there was never any effort to justify any departure from the Boland administration. In fact, what the administration did, which was just amazing, was President Reagan totally waived executive privilege to the extent I worked on the Iran-Contra Committee, to the extent that when Secretary of Defense Weinberger, Secretary of State George Shultz came up to testify, and they'd be asked, well, when you met with the president, well, what did you say and what did he say? They felt obliged to do what you would say in the past. Certainly would be out of bounds to talk about confidential discussions you had with the president. They did talk. So that's, I think, how vulnerable the president felt he was. So that's Iran-Contra, something for us. NSA eavesdropping. I think it's possible after 9/11 for the administration to say, given the emergency, we need to do something that's not in strict compliance with FISA. The administration is complying with FISA. They still use it. But they could say that FISA restricts us in a way that's threatening to the country, and momentarily, like with Lincoln, momentarily we have to do something that's not in compliance, and we are, like Clinton, going to have to come back and get better language. Now, FISA has been changed 6 or 7 times after 1978, including after 9/11. Attorney General Gonzalez took the position that it somehow couldn't be done. But the burden is on the administration, if you can't comply with law, to get language that will bring you into compliance, which this administration never did. A couple other things. I'm doing some other, as mentioned, I did a book last year on the state secrets privilege, the Supreme Court case, United States against Reynolds. That was the first time blessed the state secrets privilege, and I will give total credit to this administration for sponsoring and provoking more books and articles than I've ever done in my life. So I now am working on a second book, State Secrets Privilege, of course, as it pops up with the NSA cases, as it pops up with Extraordinary Rendition, as it pops up all over the place. And in doing this, I keep wondering about secret trials and secret evidence, and when does the public have a right to trials, and I'm getting involved in all those cases. And I came upon the Richmond newspapers. I read it again. And of course, you've all read this before. Rehnquist in his dissent, borrowing from Gilbert and Sullivan, to criticize the majority opinion. But I think it fits with presidential inherent power. I think we'll have to talk a lot about that tonight, inherent. And Gilbert and Sullivan says, the law is the true embodiment of everything that's excellent. It has no kind of fault or flaw, and I, my lords, embody the law. That was a blast at the Supreme Court by Rehnquist. I think it's where we are with inherent power. And the last thing I want to just comment on is the Steele seizure case. I'm so tired of people talking about the three categories, and I'm tired of John Roberts and Samuel Alito talking about it, and Alito getting Category 2 and Category 3 mixed up all the time. And Jackson and his concurrence in the Steele seizure case never gave that as a way to solve constitutional issues. He said, before talking about it, that there was simplistic, he said. No, it's very somewhat oversimplified grouping. And you can do your Category 1, 2, and 3, and it doesn't resolve things. And CRS last year did a fairly lengthy analysis of the NSA eavesdropping business, and they used Steele seizure. And they said this falls into Category 3, where presidential power is at its lowest ebb because it's in conflict with FISA. And I knew what's going to happen, and it happened a couple of weeks later. The Justice Department, OLC, put out this 42-page white paper relying on the three categories. It's not Category 3, it's Category 1, because, in fact, it's authorized by the authorization for use of military force. So you can game this thing forever. What you cannot game, and I think what the Federal Society should take to heart, is where Jackson comes at the end, which is appropriate for the topic tonight. Jackson at the end said, with all its defects, delays, and inconveniences, men have discovered no technique for long preserving free government except that the executive be under the law, as the law made by Congress, not by the executive branch, and that the law be made by parliamentary deliberations. When Michael Hayden was up for the CIA nomination hearings to be director, he constantly talked about this is legal, this is legal, this is legal. And you, as you read this, you know when he's talking about something being legal, it has nothing to do with Congress or statute. It has to do with some inside process where attorneys are getting together and saying this looks good. That's what this administration means by legal. And if you think I'm anti-Bush, you should see what I've written over the years about Clinton and Truman and Lyndon Johnson.
One of the prerogatives prerogatives of a moderator who's also replacing someone with conjunctivitis is to interject a few questions along the way. So I'm just going to put some questions out on the table in response to Lou's presentation before introducing our next speaker. I do think it's wonderfully bipartisan to be pro-Congress or to be pro-Constitution as to be pro-Congress or pro-executive. But I would submit that it's a bit of a cover plane to adopt that, because it seems to me to largely cover over the more difficult questions. But we'll have time in the discussion to see whether that's helpful or not. I'm not old enough to remember the Mansfield signing statement.
I'm not either.
But the Boland Amendment, it seems to me, had plenty of things not going for it. First of all, it did exist in at least six different iterations. It was hidden in an appropriations measure rather than freestanding. Even on its own terms, it was directed at those engaged in the acquisition of military intelligence. And insofar as the National Security Council is a consumer of intelligence rather than its creator, there was not only then but now a plausible argument that it had no application to it whatsoever. And even if you wanted to assume that the National Security Council was covered by the Boland Amendment, the notion that the president could not contact a foreign government for the purpose of having a conversation of support is one that would cut deeply against, it seems to me at least, the Curtis Wright theorem that is based on John Marshall's supposition that the president is indeed the organ of foreign affairs conversation in our constitutional system. I know FISA will be discussed at some length by Professor Yu and others. I do think FISA suffers from the same difficulty that the Boland Amendment suffers from, namely being constructed for a different purpose and a different time. And everybody concedes that it was constructed for a different purpose and a different time until we get into scoring rhetorical points as to whether or not the president complied or didn't comply with the statute. It obviously was an extension of the court's decision in the Keith case, and it was largely dealing with surveillance of individuals in the domestic sphere that had been abused by President Nixon for political purposes, and to the extent it had any foreign policy extension whatsoever, it was largely dealing with surveillance of diplomatic embassies and the like, which seems different than military intelligence in the context of the war on terror, or at least so I would pose. And finally, on Youngstown, I don't think we can have it both ways. The Congress of the United States has beaten President Bush over the head with Youngstown and the famous concurrence that suggests that he ignored Youngstown in the formulation of various public policy in the context of the war on terror. To the extent that Justice Jackson understood his formulation to be overly simplistic, it was not something that was apparent to Justice Frankfurter, who was worried that Justice Jackson did not understand that categorizing things in this fashion would, in fact, be overly simplistic and would not be helpful in terms of resolving the disputes that generally arise between the Congress and the President. So those are comments, and implicit in those comments, some questions that we will give Dr. Fisher an opportunity to respond after the main presentations. And the next main presentation is given by Professor John Yu, Professor of Law at the University of California at Bolt Hall. John is a graduate of Harvard College, a law graduate of the Yale Law School, clerked for Judge Silberman and Justice Thomas, has very much been involved in the center of the question as to the extent of the president's authority to, in the name of the Constitution, transcend statutory limitations, and is the author of two very recent books on this topic, The Power of War and Peace and War by Other Means. Professor Yu.
Doug, thanks for that invitation and introduction, and thanks to the Federal Society for inviting me to speak on this topic, which is, as Doug said, very near and dear to my heart, both as an academic matter and in terms of my work at the Justice Department in the first few years of the Bush administration. Tsai is probably the first law professor to get a sports injury thinking about the constitutional interpretation. And because of that, he has left me with the job of covering issues we had decided to separate. Tsai was going to talk about formalism and sort of traditional methods of constitutional interpretation and how it bears on this question. And I was going to take the fun part, which was going to be functionalism. And so I'm going to try to compress the formalist part, not because I don't think it's sort of worthy of examination, but just I hadn't prepared for it, but I did write a whole book about it, which I'm now about to summarize in 5 minutes. So I think the theory, first of all, I wouldn't say the president can disregard every national security statute just because it's about national security. I quite agree with Lou. I think Lou has an argument that's very much context-based and so on. But the theory behind it, I think, is the same theory that would apply, or the same theory that comes from Marbury versus Madison if you were actually to read Marbury versus Madison and not read articles and books about what scholars think what Marbury versus Madison says. And I think one of them, Harrison's here. So John Harrison's written an article about Marbury, sort of takes this article, this argument forward about how Marbury is really best read as a choice of law rule between conflicting sources of law, constitution versus a statute. And Mike Paulson has taken that theory and turned, I think, to more the most aggressive sort of claim that the president has the power to disregard any constitutional, any statute that the president believes to be unconstitutional. But the basic argument, as it was in Marbury, is that the Constitution is the highest source of law, and Congress cannot pass a statute that violates that law, that higher form of law. And if it does so, and the president has to choose between obeying the Constitution and obeying a statute, he has to obey the Constitution. So the question in this case is not really about, is it always about national security laws that the president can decide to ignore, but whether the president can decide not to enforce laws in the national security area which violate the Constitution. And part of that Constitution is the president's powers as commander-in-chief and chief executive. So the real interpretive question, I think, from a formalist perspective is, does the particular statute that Congress have passed actually fall within a power or an authority that we have understood or we should understand as lying within one of the president's powers as commander-in-chief and chief executive? So I would say, you know, in some areas Congress can pass legitimately laws that are constitutional the president must obey in areas such as funding, areas that have to do with its own enumerated powers like the regulation creation of the military and so on. But on the flip side, the president has exclusive authority as commander-in-chief over, it seems to me, the direction of the military, over strategic and tactical decisions. And the question that we, you know, as we talk about them, the use of force with the War Powers Resolution or FISA and the NSA wiretapping dispute or interrogation methods and the Geneva Conventions really have to do, I think, with are these efforts by Congress to regulate areas which really appropriately fall within the president's powers? And the question would be, how do we approach that? You could try to do it as an originalist matter, which I think in some of these areas is difficult, especially in the FISA NSA area. Right? We're not going to find, I hope, any original understanding about electronic surveillance and interception of communications. But you never know what Akhil's going to find next. But you can use what I think many people do use in sort of traditional forms of interpretation, which would be, say, one, practice in history, what different branches have thought over time, and so on. And so you could take that perspective with the War Powers Resolution. Right? The War Powers Resolution is a law passed by Congress that says a president can't use force abroad for longer than 60 days. No president has ever obeyed that statute. Every president, as Doug noted, always sends a note saying we're using force. It's consistent with us, consistent with the War Powers Resolution, but we won't obey it. And I think President Clinton was really the first one who actually violated its terms in the war in Kosovo. The other thing is no Congress has ever tried to enforce the War Powers Resolution. Right? No Congress has cut off funds for a war because it violated the War Powers Resolution. No Congress has undertaken other measures to try to cut off military operations because they violate the War Powers Resolution. I think you could use the same approach and same analysis with electronic surveillance of the NSA and FISA. Right? FISA is undeniably a statute that tries to place limits on the executive branch's ability to use wiretapping for national security purposes. But if you go back, presidents have exercised such an authority going back at least through Woodrow Wilson. Every president between Woodrow Wilson and Carter with the passage of FISA used an inherent authority to engage in warrantless electronic surveillance. Some of these were not necessarily taken in war itself, but instead to protect the national security. Because, and one example I'll just give here is Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt gave an order in the summer of 1940, over a year and a half before Pearl Harbor, authorizing the FBI to intercept all communications in the country, not just ones going in and out of the country, but all communications in the country that might be, quote-unquote, subversive in nature, because he was worried about the possibility of sabotage by Axis powers, with whom we were not at war at that time. So one would want to say, does intelligence gathering, and particularly to electronic surveillance, is that kind of tradition and practice in history, which I think would be better for the Justice Department to rely on rather than the claim that's authorized by Congress on September 18th, 2001, whether that tradition and practice shows that we have understood the Constitution to give that kind of intelligence gathering to the president. And what would be the point of FISA? Why is the government following FISA? I think FISA does show interesting ways in which the other branches can press back and make their own constitutional views known. For example, I think the reason the executive branch does and has to comply with FISA is because it's not, I think, very unlikely, and I think it's actually a good rule that it shouldn't use any of the evidence from the NSA warrantless wiretapping program in court to try to convict someone. In my mind, what the FISA statute does is it creates a safe harbor provision for the executive branch. If you want to try to use the criminal justice system to present evidence and convict someone who's been involved with national security threat and you want to use this inherent presidential authority, you have to do it through the FISA process. But if you don't, then you're out of luck. We may not accept it in court. So let me turn from sort of the traditional methods and of constitutional interpretation, and I'm probably done an injustice to what Tsai would have said. I'm sure he would have done it much more eloquently and talk about sort of more functional approaches, which I think are just more fun. I think functionalists generally have more fun than formalists. With functionalism, you don't have to actually do a lot of research. You don't have to read lots of old dusty pages of debates and articles. With functionalism, you can just kind of make stuff up and see whether it works. So here's my try. Here's how I would take a functionalist approach, which I was originally going to do, for examining this question. And I would say Lou and the late John Hart Ely and many of the critics of presidential power in wartime make very explicit functional arguments, which I think basically run along this. War is a dangerous enterprise. It can be quite disastrous for the United States. Because of that, we should slow down the process for going to war. And in fact, we should, and Ely says this quite explicitly in his book on war powers, we should make it as difficult as possible to go to war. We should make sure that every branch, everybody agrees that war is a good idea before going into it because it is so risky and dangerous to the security of the country. And I guess from a functionalist perspective, one ought to ask, is this right? Is this assumption correct? Is war always a bad thing? Or is it always inherently risky or dangerous? It's certainly not the case that every war the United States fights is a bad one. Right? The United States has certainly waged wars which, despite our claims that we always act in our self-defense, I think the United States has certainly waged aggressive wars in the past, like the Mexican-American War or the Spanish-American War, which I think turned out quite well for the country and led to large expansions of the country's territory. So I don't think one can just say war is always just inherently a bad idea. The second thing is that this functionalist claim is really designed for one kind of mistake, the mistake when you go to war when you shouldn't have gone to war. And certainly Vietnam might have been an example. People are saying Iraq is an example right now. But what it ignores is the other kind of error, another kind of mistake our system could have, which is that we don't go to war when we should have gone to war. And I think we often forget today which the case, which I think was very much on the minds of the people who thought about this issue in the 1950s and 60s, which was World War II. If you think about World War II, we had an isolationist Congress, which had passed a series of neutrality acts to prevent the United States from getting involved with the wars between the Allies and Axis powers. And President Roosevelt essentially, I think, took a number of actions which violated those statutes, led us into an undeclared naval war with Germany, well before the Pearl Harbor attacks. And there, the question is, right, as just a matter of selection of the right kinds of conflicts, wouldn't it have been better for the United States to have entered that war earlier? Wasn't it a mistake that our system made it so difficult to go to war in World War II that it actually caused harm to the country? It could have caused even more harm to the country if the Japanese had not attacked us in Pearl Harbor and the United States had delayed its intervention. So let me conclude this. If you're going to take this functionalist perspective, then I think really what you ought to do, not to do is say, well, we need to design a system as difficult as possible to make war or as easy as possible to make war, but you want to have a process to make war that's very much a product of the context you want to, that we exist in today. Right? So you want to have a sense of, on the one side, the cost that you're going to have if you create and require the government to go through costly and slow procedures to make these kinds of national security decisions. And you have to balance that against the benefits for speed, the benefits of being able to act secretly and quickly. There may be some kind of context, certainly like the late 18th century, where there was not a great premium on speed, right, where you would create the military for the war. You would sometimes decide to go to war before you even had a military, and you had months to prepare for war and to create the military necessary. And the thing to ask yourselves is that today's environment, one where we are, which is characterized by terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda, WMD proliferation, and rogue states, about how that balance should cut against that kind of environment. And the last thing I'll say there is, and do we really expect Congress, and do we really want Congress to play this sort of leading role in making decisions in that context? Right, if you think about sort of contemporary theories of political science, they would say that we would never expect Congress to even want to pass a law in the war powers area when faced with these kinds of threats, because Congress doesn't want to take positions on controversial subjects where it could turn out to be wrong and make a serious mistake for the country, or when no matter what you do, a significant proportion of the population is going to be angry. So what you would expect to see and what you do see, I would argue, is that Congress would pass laws, create a military that can be used for offensive operations. You know, there's a reason the United States has all these carrier battle groups, and it's not to defend the ports of Miami and San Francisco. Right? That the reasons we have as large a military as the other 15 nations combined following us, and the reason that Congress has created a weapon for the president to use for offensive military operations if he needs to, and Congress is not going to, as a political matter, step in and try to pass a law one way or another to restrict the president's ability to use it. Thanks.
Before introducing our final speaker, again, I want to operate in fairness to pose a few questions to Professor Yu. Professor Yu indicated that he had a double burden tonight to both present the formal as well as the functional. I would like to suggest, John, that maybe the formal and functional in your analysis are in fact merged, that the formal is functional, and that to the extent that when one looks at the sources that were available to the founders, one finds, again, Locke's statement that the federative or foreign affairs power is to, quote, act according to discretion for the public good without the prescription of law and sometimes even against it. And so that the distinction that we usually make in the domestic side between formal and functional disappears in this context, and that's one of the things we probably should admit straight up. On the other hand, there's also evidence that on this issue of war being dangerous, that there is sentiment expressed by some in the founding generation that the power of Congress was intended to be a clog on war. And if indeed it was intended to be a clog on war, how successful and by what means is Congress carrying out that clogging function, admitting the fact, as you very thoughtfully suggest, that war is not always a bad idea if we win. The practical matter is that we don't know in advance whether we will win or not, and one can no longer depend upon technological superiority to guess at that outcome. In particular, John, in, as we get into the discussion period, there was a sentence that caught my attention in your first volume on War and Peace, and you write as follows: Congress needs no check on the president through the Declare War Clause because it already possesses all the power it needs. Congress at any time may use its power of the purse to counter presidential war making. Indeed, all Congress need to do is what they're good at. He doesn't say that. Nothing. By refusing actively to authorize the existence of armed forces or appropriate additional monies to fund the wars. The essential question is, especially in light of your statement, John, in your presentation, that no Congress has seriously tried to cut off an executive with the use of funding. How, indeed, whether that functional prescription to protect us against a warmongering president actually operates. Our final speaker is Ilya Soman. Ilya Soman is an assistant professor at the George Mason School of Law. Because he teaches primarily in the area of property law, we thought this
actually
was and constitutional law. It was a joke, Ilya. we thought that having been nurtured in property law, the queen of all sciences, as I used to like to say to my property law students, that he would be have particular insight into this area. Professor Soman clerked for Judge Jerry Smith on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. His education is at Amherst, at Harvard, and his law degree is from Yale, and we welcome Ilya Soman. Professor Soman.
Thank you. Well, it ultimately comes down to a question of who has the property right over the power to make these decisions, perhaps, so I can unify it with my other field in that respect. I think often discussions about presidential executive power come down to sort of a question of whose ox is being gored. If you like the president that's in power currently, then you argue for a broad view of executive power. And if you don't like him or his policies, then by contrast, you argue for a narrow one. In this panel, I hope we can perhaps get beyond that, at least to some extent. And to further that, I would just remind the Republicans here that in 2 years, there may well be a Democratic president. And for the Democrats here, I'd like to remind you of the exact same thing, and that the war on terror probably will not be over by that time, and therefore whatever powers we say now should belong to the Bush administration will also most likely belong also to its successors as well. Like John Yoo, I have both a formalist and a functionalist part to my presentation, and in brief, I'm going to argue in both phases that for the most part, it is in fact Congress which has the power to regulate in this area, and if they pass an explicit statute, the president, with perhaps one minor caveat that I'm going to mention, would not have the right to violate it. But I do want to emphasize, because the discussion has gone a little bit beyond this, that I'm going to focus primarily on what the central question of the panel was initially about, and that is whether the president has the power to explicitly violate a statute that Congress has enacted. The power that the president has in the absence of congressional action is a different type of question and one that I'm not going to have time to address, at least in this particular statement, although perhaps we can take questions about it later. So first, the formal constitutional argument for why, in fact, it is Congress that has the power to regulate the use of armed force and to set laws that the president has to obey in this area. Often in constitutional law, and even occasionally in property law, we get a lot of grist for our mill from the fact that the law is actually pretty vague. It's not clear what it actually means. For example, I've been known to write about a phrase known as public use where it's not entirely clear what is a public use, does it actually have to be physically used by the public or not, and so on. In this area, I think the Constitution is actually much more clear than it is on many other controversial issues, and that is it's clear in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 14 of the Constitution, which gives Congress the power to, quote, make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. Now, there's two interesting things about this phrase. One is that it is, in fact, pretty clear. It seems to specifically give Congress the power to regulate the land and naval forces, and I would assume, by extension, today, the Air Force as well. Second, this power is plenary. I know the word plenary has been much abused in constitutional law, and I myself have been critical of some of that abuse. However, this really is a plenary power in the sense that the Article 1 does not limit Congress's power to regulate the armed forces to any particular subject. It doesn't say, well, we can set out regulations except those which might infringe on the president's tactical discretion, or except those that deal with the treatment of prisoners, or with electronic surveillance, and so forth. Basically, by the terms of this clause, anything that has to do with the control of the land and naval forces and the armed force in general, Congress has the constitutional power to regulate. Now, some scholars, including some of my distinguished fellow panelists, have argued that maybe the Commander-in-Chief Clause of Article 2 constrains this congressional power. I would suggest not. Certainly, the Commander-in-Chief Clause does give the president the power to be the highest-ranking general and admiral, and I guess Coast Guard would also have admirals and so forth. So he's certainly the highest-ranking military commander of all of the armed forces. But the Commander-in-Chief Clause nowhere gives the president the power to make law, nor does it give the president the power to disregard congressionally enacted law, except perhaps a law which says that, say, General Casey, the American commander in Iraq, has the power to disobey President Bush's military orders, and, you know, he becomes the highest-ranking military commander. To the contrary, the Commander-in-Chief Clause, by associating the president with the military, suggests that in situations where he acts as the commander of the military and exercises his war powers, he is, in fact, a part of the land and naval forces referred to in Article 1 of the Constitution. To the extent that the president is acting in a military capacity, he is subject to Congress's regulatory power under Article 1, no less than the rest of the military is. Certainly, a congressional law under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 14, that a general cannot disobey is also one that the president, acting as commander-in-chief, additionally cannot disobey. So to my mind here, we have a very strong textualist argument for why, in fact, Congress has broad and plenary power in this area. And I think in this case, textualism is the preferred mode of constitutional interpretation, but it's particularly important in this instance and particularly valid here because, as John suggests, often we do not have good originalist evidence outside the text as to what the framers might have wanted or intended for particular modern military controversies. And to my mind, that just strengthens the case for sticking to the text of the Constitution and for making that the primary font of constitutional interpretation. Now I'd like to get to the more fun and more sexy functionalist arguments for why not only Congress has the legal authority to regulate in this area, but actually it's not such a bad idea to allow them to do so. And while I can't guarantee that we won't all die because Congress passes a horrible or excessive regulation on presidential war powers, I think at the very least it's unlikely, and that actually the threat of presidential abuse may be a more severe danger. So certainly, I do admit, as John has suggested in his writings and other presentations, that it is possible that Congress would enact regulations that over-regulate the president's war powers, unduly constrain his discretion, and so forth. That's a legitimate concern, and there's nothing that I can say that can convince you that that can never possibly happen. However, there are two reasons to believe that this threat actually is not that great and is unlikely to be realized, at least in the vast majority of cases. One is that, as John himself suggested, Congress is sensitive to its political reputation and certainly will not want to be blamed for losing a war by unduly constraining presidential discretion. Certainly, the Bush administration has used this argument to its political advantage several times, and it's striking that Congress has not, in fact, for the most part, tried to move to constrain the Bush administration. It's also striking to me that even though the incoming Democratic Congress, they certainly, to put it mildly, have no great love for President Bush, nonetheless, military issues and war powers issues are striking by their absence from the Democrats' so-called 100-hour program, and it seems like they have little, if any, real intent of seriously constraining Bush's discretion through passing regulations. But let's assume that Congress was more aggressive than the Democrats currently seem inclined to be. Still, the president has a powerful weapon to prevent them from overregulating, namely the veto power. In practice, Congress could only severely overregulate the president if they had a two-thirds majority in both houses for doing so, and that suggests that in order to achieve that majority, they would need to have the support of a substantial number of congressmen and senators from the president's own political party. And we have in the audience one of my sometime co-authors, John McGinnis, who's often written about supermajorities, and as John can tell you, if there really is such strong bipartisan supermajority support for a limitation on presidential power, then there is a good chance, not a certain chance, but a good chance that whatever presidential action Congress is trying to constrain probably isn't a particularly desirable presidential action in the first place. So I don't know if John necessarily actually agrees with me on this issue, but I'm going to appropriate this part of his theory nonetheless to further my position. On the other hand, if you adopt the opposite view that essentially the president has inherent control in this area, then he too can engage in abusive behavior, and he too might do things that might cause us to lose the war, and yet Congress, even with a supermajority, would not have the ability to constrain him, and I would argue actually that that's a more serious threat to concentrate that power to make abusive or simply flawed and mistaken decisions in the hands of one person in a small circle of advisors than to give that power to a congressional supermajority that the president could constrain through his veto power. And I think that the empirical record suggests that, in fact, the threat of congressional overregulation, while not a totally meaningless danger, is at least to some extent overblown. Finally, as I've promised, there is one caveat to my general conclusion that, in fact, congressional power prevails in this area, and that is that, as Thomas Jefferson said, while adherence to the Constitution is an extremely important good, it is not the only good, and it may not be the most important one. So there may be, as Lou Fisher suggested, extreme situations where the president might be justified in acting illegally and unconstitutionally. For instance, if the only choices were to disobey a congressional statute or to allow the country to be conquered by a hostile totalitarian power that would create vast slave labor camps and so forth, then yes, I would say the president should act unconstitutionally in that situation because the alternative is even worse. However, such situations, I think, are extremely rare. I think it makes a big difference between saying that it's in some extreme cases the president can be justified in acting unconstitutionally and saying essentially that under the Constitution itself, the president can legally do almost anything he wants in a national security area. The former position, I think, is defensible, whereas the latter one, while certainly some arguments he made in his behalf, I think the latter is ultimately unpersuasive. And in fact, the Constitution assigns the primary regulatory authority in this area to Congress. Thank you.
Well, one last battery of questions to allow the panel to respond to the questions and to other things they've heard. Ilya, if I've understood you correctly, you have indicated that, in your judgment, all of this speculation that has gone before is unnecessarily because the Constitution is reasonably plain, that Congress has the dominant role in terms of the regulation of land and naval forces, and that the commander-in-chief is just simply an aspect of those land and naval forces and should follow the direction of the president. I guess my question then would be, to what degree can Congress or could the Congress have, say, countermanded FDR in his participation in D-Day, or constrained JFK in his efforts with respect to Cuba or in other military exercises? To what degree do you just simply discount the aspect of Justice Jackson's admonition in Youngstown that you can find apt quotations on either side of the congressional or presidential side of the ledger to suit your purposes, and your argument to some degree that Congress has the explicit authority is merely that side of the ledger? It's too much of a quip to say that Lou argued that the president must follow the law, that John argued that war can sometimes be good for us, and that Ilya said we probably won't all die.
I did say that.
But I pretty much have that as the summary, and with that as a somewhat too cute introduction, I will allow Lou to be the first to speak and respond to any of this, and then we're going to turn it over to your questions.
A bunch. I think I'll stand up. Doug, talking about the Boland Amendment, said that the Boland Amendment specifically named the Department of Defense, National Security Agency, all the ones, Central Intelligence Agency, of course, didn't mention the National Security Council. I mean, that's not a serious argument where you talk about all the departments of government that are operational and don't talk about the one that is not supposed to be operational, supposed to make sure the president doesn't get blindsided. And no one in OLC, as you know, Doug, since you were there, ever made that argument on paper. You can make it here at a conference, but it's an absurd argument to say that the National Security Council can do what the Defense Department, the CIA, et cetera, could not do. Oh, Doug talked about the Curtis Wright case, Seoul, Oregon. That gets a 10 on shallowness. There's no constitutional argument that's more shallow than the Seoul, Oregon argument, which is not only dicta in Curtis Wright, but takes John Marshall's comment totally out of context to say something that John Marshall never meant as Secretary of State or as a member of Congress where he made it, or on the Supreme Court, never took a position that the president is sole organ and giving him exclusive power over foreign affairs. It was that when Congress, in the context, passes an extradition statute, the president is the one carried out. What's the big deal about that? That's the context. A couple of weeks ago, I did in Legal Times a two-page on this. I mentioned John Dew and Judge Posner and a few others, the OLC. But I have a longer paper. If anyone's interested, I've done about a 30-page paper on the sole organ argument. It's an awful argument.
Thank you
FISA, so much. FISA, different purpose, different times. Yeah, 1978. You can update it, as it has been done. We've amended FISA many times. You can, and it's broad language in there. You don't have to say some new technological wrinkle came up that makes FISA of no use anymore. John Yoo, you know, I'm not a law professor. I've taught at law schools, but I'm not a law professor the way you are, or the audience. I do not understand. He says I'm a functionalist, not a formalist, that war is dangerous. I have no idea what that means. I think that the Constitution is based on certain understandings about political players. John Jay in Federalist Number 4 put it very well. If he looks at history, executives are constantly getting countries into wars that are not in the national interest. It's for some personal interest, some party interest, some family interest. That was the understanding. And they wrote a Constitution. So there's no gap between formal and functional. The two are the same. Couple of others. Oh, the Mexican War, John says it was pretty good, got more territory. I'm thinking, of course, Nazi Germany going into Poland and Austria, got a little Lebensraum. And even more recently, I thought Iraq going into Kuwait was a bad thing. They were just getting a little more territory. It's pretty good. Ilya says it depends whether you like the current president. I mean, there's a lot of truth to that, but I think that's an awful thing for any of us to try to promote.
And it leads to problems where people who, Republicans who liked Reagan and blessed what he did in the national security area, when Clinton comes along, they look at what he's doing, they blanch at it, but they've already taken the gun, got their feet in the mud with Reagan, so they keep it in the mud with Clinton. Nobody should feel any obligation to support a particular president. No one should have any obligation to support a particular Congress or a particular court. There's no reason to do that. And we didn't say so, but if you talk about Commander-in-Chief Clause, I mean, there are some things that's there for. One is unity of command. It's very, very important. You don't want some admiral or general taking over. And that leads to the second important point, civilian supremacy. Otherwise, you cannot read the Constitution to say that because the president is Commander-in-Chief, he can do what he wants with forces regardless of what Congress says or has provided. I think the Constitution was very clear that anything of an offensive nature required congressional action either by declaration or by authorization. And that was the case up until Truman, and he broke that. Another whole story. But for 160 years, we followed the Constitution of offensive war as being Congress was the only body that could take the country from a state of peace to a state of war.
Well, my old boss, President Reagan, used to say you should never argue with someone who buys ink by the barrel. He used to say that about taking on the press. I think a corollary proposition is you should never argue with someone who is a splendid scholar of the history of the United States. And Dr. Fisher is quite right that the statements in Curtis Wright come out of that extradition dispute that John Adams had with Congress. The one little addendum I will have about that is that John Marshall opined that the matters of war and peace are as pellucid and as clear as the distinction between commerce and local power. John.
Because there's only 15 minutes left, I'll wait for the questions from the audience.
Any possible response on the functionality of the funding limitation and the fact that Congress, by your own admission, doesn't use it very much?
Yeah, just quickly, I would say, that doesn't mean that Congress didn't have a choice, if that's what people want. I mean, the other people on the panel want Congress to have a say. The Kosovo War is a good example, which is a very small conflict by modern standards. Even in that small conflict, which never involved ground troops, Congress still had to affirmatively vote money for the air war. And they had an opportunity not to vote that money, and the war could not have been conducted without that additional funding. So I don't think it's a constitutional point. I think it's a political point, which Congress doesn't want to stop wars of this nature. They have every opportunity to do so, but I don't think it's a constitutional defect. I think it's just a political choice that Congress is making. I will make one smaller point about isn't it good for Congress to clog the decision-making process. I think there's a lot of truth to that domestically. Because in the absence of action by Congress, there's still always a body of state law regulating affairs. It's not as if no action is taken by government at all. But in the absence of congressional action, I'm sorry, national governmental action in the war powers area, I think the cost of the country can be a great deal higher because there is no sort of pre-existing body of regulation that is, regulating potential harms to the country. If Congress doesn't act, then those harms might materialize.
And following up on that, Ilya, any response to my question about the Congress's ability to interfere with, say, FDR and his planning for D-Day?
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to first very briefly comment on what he just said and then comment on the two questions that you quite properly posed. I think the analogy that you just made to the Commerce Clause and national versus local power is very much the point. In the Commerce Clause debate, we have people primarily on the other side of the political spectrum from Doug who say, well, anything that even remotely connects to interstate commerce, Congress has the power to regulate, essentially giving Congress virtually unlimited power. And similarly, we have people this time more, at least right this time, more on the right side of the political spectrum, who say, well, if it's national security, anything even remotely related to national security, the president has virtually unlimited power to control that. To my mind, both of these doctrines are mistaken, and both, I think, are at odds with a textualist interpretation of the Constitution, and I think, therefore, both have common flaws. And as for a particular question that Doug asked, yes, it's true. Under my approach, Congress would have the ability to pass a law which says, for instance, the president is forbidden to send troops into Europe and therefore can't launch, or I'm sorry, into continental Europe and therefore can't launch the D-Day invasion. I would point out that at least as a formal matter, the same thing is true on John Yoo's theory as well, in that Congress could pass a statute saying that no U.S. funds shall be spent on an invasion of France between 1944 and 1950 or whatever date you want to say. So as a formal matter, this risk exists with both views. But in practice, this is the kind of law school hypothetical that has little, if any, application to the real world, because for the reason indicated in my presentation, Congress will have strong political incentives not to do things like that, namely that it will not want to be blamed for losing the war. As John just pointed out, they were unwilling to do this sort of thing even with the Kosovo invasion, where the stakes for the U.S. were much lower than with respect to D-Day. Now, your second question you posed, as I understand, was sort of a question, well, there might be apt authorities that people can cite on both sides of the questions. I agree with that. There are often apt authorities. Anybody can play with quotations. To my mind, as a textualist, a quotation is actually from the text of the Constitution has greater weight than other quotations that one could put forward. I did also deal with my initial statement with the principal constitutional text that is cited by the other side, the Commander-in-Chief Clause, and I tried to explain why, far from somehow countering or trumping Congress's power in this area, it actually underscores it by associating the president with the very land and naval forces that Congress under Article I has the power to regulate. I did not mean to endorse in my statement the attitude that people should take their position on this based on whether they like the president in power. I was merely empirically noting that that seems to be the pattern. Sorry.
Very good. First question.
I guess this is a function of questions. Doug is right about the Jay quote that the founders feared that the ambitious executives would get us into foreign wars, and we needed Congress to trim that back. And they did trim back the power over foreign affairs that the King of England had enjoyed. At the time, there were no term limits on the president, and they hypothesized that a president could get reelected, for a very long time. What's actually happened since that time is that the president has been term limited, and the Congress has something very much like lifetime terms. Does that change in expectation change the desirability of who has the dominant decision-making power here? The question is suggested by the point that Congress has been very, very cautious in challenging the president. And one reason is that, a congressman who wants to stay there for forever has to be very cautious about re-election, where a president may be in a second term and say, what the heck, I'll just do what's right. So I'm just wondering if the change in term limits and effective length of terms has anything to say about the functional desirability of distribution of decision making power.
I was the one, not Doug, but I was the one who brought up Jay and number four.
Sorry.
We look pretty much alike. I don't think the fact that the president's limited to two terms makes any difference at all. I think that the founders were looking at history executives, what their motivations are, what their behavior is, and they didn't like what they saw. And I think if you look at the last couple wars, it's clean like Vietnam. Take the Gulf of Tonkin resolution situation. There was one incident that was not a basis to go to war against Vietnam. There's a second incident that we now know did not happen. The NSA released all the stuff on that. So you had a really odd, you had something a little ambiguous on the second attack in the Gulf of Tonkin. And if you read the tapes of Lyndon Johnson, when he's talking to people, he is doing exactly what the framers were worried about. He is worried that Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon will go after him if he doesn't show something very masculine and manly. He's doing it for partisan, political person, every reason you can think of exactly. So that observation by John Jay in Federalist No. 4, I think has been very, very true about the way presidents act, about Truman not wanting to lose Korea and everything else. I think what the framers understood then in 18th century applies just as well today.
I do think it's an interesting question in terms of why the functional indeterminacy of Congress's term, the incumbency that seems to be impervious to attack, why that hasn't led to a more aggressive assertion of Congress's limitation. I don't know if John or Ilya has a response to that. Ilya mentioned that no Congress worth its political salt would actually, for fear of being blamed, limit the president in his necessary war power. But, of course, that's exactly the argument that President Bush makes against the proposed limitations on his authority to engage in the terrorist surveillance program. It's not something that says, Mr. Bush, you can't fight the war on the ground in Afghanistan or in Iraq in a particular way. But it is saying something to the president. You can't gather information in a way that you think necessary to prevent a further attack on the United States. And from the president's perspective in terms of priorities, I think that may in fact be a more direct challenge to his presidential judgment than even whether or not a given battalion should be in a sector of Baghdad today or on Friday. Any thoughts on either of those aspects of those questions?
Sure. Just briefly, on the NSA, obviously there's a large and complicated issue here, much of which is beyond my expertise. But I would say that to the extent that Doug is right, and I think you probably are right, that statute was in many ways outdated. I think President Bush had many opportunities between 2001 and 2005 or 6 to get it revised, and most likely Congress would have given him most, if not all, of what he wanted, for precisely the reason I suggested that they wouldn't want to be blamed for losing the war, or even for creating a perception that they are causing us to lose the war. With respect to the issue of re-election and changes from the 1780s, obviously there have been changes, but I would note that, as the last election showed, Congress's position is not as secure as some people think. The position of senators has never been tremendously secure. It is true that House members in safe districts tend to be very secure, and that may be a bad thing in various ways. However, in any close congressional vote, the relevant people are the congressmen in swing districts, and those people often are at least somewhat insecure in their seats and therefore have at least some incentive to avoid being blamed for losing a war. I do not contend that Congress will never pass stupid or overly restrictive regulations. They can and they will, but I think their tendency to do so would be limited by political considerations and also by the president's veto power, which is quite significant in this area.
David?
I shall be brief. If we're going to be textualists, let's be textualists. The Constitution does not say that Congress has the power to regulate the use of armed forces. It says Congress has the power to pass rules for the government and regulation of the armed forces. That's clearly the idea of command and control and internal regulations. You contrast that contextually to the commerce power. Even if commerce is defined narrowly, Congress regulates commerce. Nowhere can you say that in the government passing rules for the government and regulation of the armed forces does Congress have the right to regulate the use of the armed forces. That's exactly what the commander-in-chief power is about.
Roger?
My question exactly on point. I mean, the problem, as I see it, Ilya, with your argument from Article 1, Section 8, Clause 14, is that it's supported neither by theory nor history nor cases. Apart from that, it's a fine argument.
Thank you.
Because it brings out the problem of textualism in this area. And I commend you for being a consistent textualist with respect to Commerce Clause and here. But the problem is that the Constitution is woefully underdetermined in the foreign affairs area, which is why you have to turn to things like theory, history, and the cases. In fact, you look at Jefferson, Hamilton, a point of rare agreement they said that the president's power is plenary in these areas, and that Congress's powers, except as qualified by Congress's powers, which are to be narrowly construed. And you, what you're doing is reading the clause, as David said, which was meant to provide for uniform code of military justice, the way people read, for example, the clause relating to captures. That has nothing to do with captures of people the way people are reading it today. It has to do with captures of ships and other spoils of war. So if you're going to be a textualist, you're in the wrong area of the Constitution.
Hilliam, response?
It's twofold. First of all, to the extent that Roger and others who want to read this clause narrowly concede that it authorizes things like the Uniform Code of Military Justice, well, the Uniform Code of Military Justice does, in fact, regulate some issues which do relate to tactics, such as the capture of prisoners, their treatment after being captured, aspects is constitutional. The UCMJ certainly does regulate the use of military force, because, for instance, if the UCMJ says that you can't shoot prisoners out of hand, then the president cannot use his military forces to do that very thing. Similarly, there are other examples of this type that can be cited. And I readily grant that some types of regulations that Congress could adopt under this power might be unwise or stupid or harmful. I think certainly the hypothetical we talked about earlier with respect to DITA is an excellent example of that. I think what the Constitution does is sets up a system of political incentives to try to minimize abuse of both congressional and presidential power. And for the reason I've suggested, while we can't rule out the possibility that Congress would adopt stupid regulations, I think there's a good incentive structure in place to minimize that.
I want to, John, did you have a comment?
I just have, about the constitutional text point is that I think there are assumptions built in into what you think regulation means versus commander-in-chief means, but the other thing you would do as a textualist, I think, is compare this provision to other provisions of the Constitution. And I always make this point. No one really seems to think it's important, but I'm going to try one last time. If no one thinks it's important, I won't say it ever again. But there's another alternate war-making system in the constitutional text itself, which is Article 1, Section 10, which regulates the ability of states to wage war. And it says, it's a very interesting provision. It says, no state shall engage in war without the consent of Congress, except in cases of invasion and or delay. It's exactly the system that, you know, Lou and I think Ilya would like. Why doesn't Congress, why didn't the framers use that exact same words and just say, the president shall not make war without, and da-da-da-da-da, but do exactly, with all the exceptions for invasions and attacks and self-defense that people want to recognize. So the thing that's odd about it is that the framers did not choose to use a very specific language used elsewhere in the Constitution to create that system, and instead I think create what Roger called a fairly indeterminate system where you don't have step-by-step procedures. You have this division of authorities that the king used to have all concentrated in the British Constitution, which seems to me to imply a more indeterminate war-making process. It's not Congress-first based.
Lou, not to put you on the spot, but John has articulated it well again this evening and several times in books and articles. Why isn't the Declare War Clause merely reflective of the historical tradition of declaring the legal relationships as a consequence of war as opposed to an authorization clause, especially when compared to the other provision in Article 1, Section 10?
Yeah, John, as I think most people know, that takes the Declare War Law as some juridical value of announcing without limiting the president. I can only say if you look at the first 160 years, all three branches understood that the Congress was the only branch with authority to take the country from a state of peace to a state of war. And the framers, as John knows, understood that the president might have to repel sudden attacks. So that was always a recognition that certain defensive powers on the part of the president, offensive powers were in Congress. If you even look, I mean, the Justice Department will cite the Price cases of 1863. And in there, Justice Greer said, in upholding Lincoln, the blockade, we're talking about a domestic war. We're not talking about a war against another country. If we were, that's for Congress alone. And the attorney, Richard Henry Dana Jr., who was representing Lincoln, said exactly the same thing. This only has to do with a domestic matter. Anything of an offensive nature would be for the body that has the sovereign power, and he said that's Congress. So that was the understanding for 160 years until Truman.
But can you explain hundreds of military interventions on that basis?
Oh, we did have. I don't think you can take all these 200 examples of whatever it is, chasing bandits into Mexico and so forth, as any sort of authority for the president to go offensive war. Now, that was just not the understanding. All three branches understood that. Okay. And the reason Truman got away, we got it confused with the UN and NATO also. You're having a treaty by two branches taking out the House of Representatives.
I want to take two more questions and then conclude somewhere close to our end time. Yes, sir.
I have a question for John. John, I was hoping you could defend the legitimacy of what you call the functionalist approach. So you somewhat jokingly described it as doing no research, making stuff up, and seeing what works. Although, even though I assume you meant that as a joke, there's actually something to that and what you're doing. So in your new book, War by Other Means, say, well, in a war, you really need a strong Article 2. In fact, if you don't have that, it's really hard to fight the war because bad things could happen. Therefore, we must have a strong Article 2. In other words, sort of what seems to be a good workable system must be constitutionally required. Yeah. And that strikes me as a troubling mode of constitutional interpretation. In fact, if the Federal Society is about anything, it would seem to me about rejecting that as a mode of constitutional interpretation. So I was hoping, especially in front of this crowd, you could defend that set of ideas as a normative principle of interpretation.
Please don't, and I highly recommend this to people who are Federal Society members and faculty, not to follow my career path or anything I've done as some kind of role model for academic success. So let's start there. I guess one thing is, and this is sort of a meta-scholarly level, is I hate to say it, but I think that formalist arguments have made some headway in constitutional discourse. But I think in the end they are dismissed by sort of the mainstream or the majority of people who do constitutional law in the legal academy. I think that's terrible and unfortunate, but I think you see it kind of gets segregated off in the academic discourse. And so I personally, the first book I wrote is a whole book about the text and history of the Constitution in the war powers area. And so I think it's important, but I think most people in the academy are more interested in functional arguments for a variety of reasons. And I was joking. It's not just that it requires less work, although it clearly does. But I think that if you read constitutional law scholarship in any area, right, I think the dominant voices, the mainstream of the field is in these functional areas, right? And it's much more so the case in the Bill of Rights areas than it is in the functional areas, too.
Do you make the argument that I sort of was provoking before that
textual war is good for us?
The textual argument really is a functional argument. Hamilton's notion that the circumstances that endanger the safety of nations are infinite and need that pliability.
I quite agree. I mean, and this goes to this sort of meta-scholarly point. I mean, I actually use originalism in the war powers area to defeat the idea that the Constitution has this definite, fixed understanding about the process used to go to war. I use originalism just more to attack the arguments that Liu and Ely made quite some time ago and continue to make, which is that there's this clear process to make war and that all the wars we've had since World War II are unconstitutional. Right? And so, or most except for Persian Gulf I and Persian Gulf II and Afghanistan. So I actually think that the original understanding material.
Vietnam was authorized, right?
Vietnam. Right? But I would say that the original understanding about what those phrases in the Constitution mean are not so clear. And I actually think that's a very useful thing to use originalism for, actually, is to show at times how it excludes certain kinds of arguments. But I can't defend the legitimacy of functionalism as sort of if one was a justice of the Supreme Court, that one ought to actually approach the separation of powers in this way, although many justices have. I personally don't agree with it.
Professor Barnett, who clarified the commerce power, had the last question.
I was just going to make a brief footnote point, because I find myself in always in these discussions in agreement with the last person I heard speaking. I have a minute in my mind. But the one thing is that when I was doing research on the meaning of the word regulate, the core meaning of the word, the original meaning of the word regulate was to make regular, or if you want to accomplish something, here's how you go about doing it. And so I think it's interesting that the plausibility of focusing on is broader than the meaning than the word regulate. It uses govern and regulate. Govern is a much stronger discretionary power when it's used elsewhere in the Constitution as well than regulate is, and that Congress would be given the power both to regulate
Ray,
and
it's
to
not govern. Govern, it's government. It passes rules for the government. It's a structural thing. Well, it's not a policy.
David, you may be right, and I really don't have a dog. I do have a dog in this fight since I'm an American, but I don't really know who I agree with.
Just the right words.
Right, but it is a broader power. It's not just the power to regulate. It's Congress is given in that text a broader power than just that power itself.
Yeah. I'd like to thank the Federalist Society, and in particular Gene Meyer, for arranging this panel. I'd like to thank Professor Yu, Professor Soman, and Dr. Fisher, all excellently done. And let's take comfort in the fact that Congress has not done anything that will probably not cause us to die.
not in the war powers area. Don't forget the FDA drug approval process.